Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Thursday, March 10th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Mesa County, jury indicts Peters, deputy. Airstrike hits maternity hospital in Ukraine, 17 reported wounded. By Yevgeny Maloletka. House okays $13.6 billion for Ukraine in huge spending bill. By Alan Fram. Obituary. Denver jazz icon Ron Miles dies at 58. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Mesa County. Jury indicts Peters, deputy. By Saja Hindi. The Denver Post. A Mesa County grand jury returned 10 criminal counts against Mesa County Clerk and Recorder Tina Peters and 6 counts against Deputy Clerk Belinda Nisley in its investigation over a potential election equipment security breach. The grand jury was impaneled at the end of January to investigate allegations of election equipment tampering and official misconduct and returned its findings Tuesday evening. Peters, a Republican who launched a bid for Secretary of State, has been charged with 3 counts of attempting to influence a public servant, criminal impersonation, 2 counts of conspiracy to commit criminal impersonation, and identity theft, all felonies, according to the Mesa County District Attorney's Office. She also is charged with first-degree official misconduct, violation of duty, and failing to comply with the Secretary of State. All misdemeanors. Nisley was charged with 3 counts of attempting to influence a public servant and 1 count of conspiracy to commit criminal impersonation, all felonies, and misdemeanors, violation of duty, and failing to comply with the Secretary of State. Authorities issued warrants for Peters and Nisley's arrests with $500,000 bail for each of the local officials, whose duties include overseeing county elections. Nisley and Peters turned themselves in Wednesday afternoon at the Mesa County Jail. The charges stem from local, state, and federal investigations launched into the potential breach after the Secretary of State sued Peters, a 2020 election denier, and Nisley over allegedly allowing an unauthorized man access to make copies of voting equipment servers. Passwords from the equipment were posted online by a leading figure in the QAnon conspiracy theory, Ron Watkins. In November, the FBI, state, and local authorities searched 4 locations in connection with the investigation over the possible election security breach, including Peter's home. The indictment and arrest documents say that beginning in April 2021, before the Dominion Voting Systems Election Equipment Trusted Build process started, a routine software update, Peters and Nisley devised and executed a deceptive scheme which was designed to influence public servants, breach security protocols, exceed permissible access to voting equipment, and set in motion the eventual distribution of confidential information to unauthorized people. Furthermore, these defendants, without permission or lawful authorization, also used the name and personal identifying information of Gerald Jerry Wood to further their criminal scheme. This unlawful use of Mr. Wood's identity by Tina Peters and Belinda Nisley also subjected Mr. Wood to various forms of liability and criminal exposure, the indictment stated. Wood was named as the unauthorized person who allegedly was given access to the county's secure elections area, although Wood testified and provided evidence to the grand jury that he did not access the area during the trusted build process or a couple of days prior, despite his badge being used, according to the indictment and arrest documents. In October, a judge also barred Peters and Nisley from overseeing the 2021 election. And after Peters refused to follow new protocols, the Secretary of State sued her again to stop her from overseeing the 2022 election. Peters is also under investigation by the state's Independent Ethics Committee over two complaints, is facing campaign finance complaints in the State Office of Administrative Courts, has been charged over allegations of obstructing a peace officer and government operations, and was issued a citation over an allegation of contempt of court in another criminal case. Nisley is facing charges of burglary and a cybercrime after she allegedly entered the county offices during a suspension in an unrelated case. She has pleaded not guilty to those charges. A joint statement from District Attorney Dan Rubenstein and Attorney General Phil Weiser said a grand jury of citizens concluded there was probable cause for the charges. This investigation is ongoing, and other defendants may be charged as we learn more information, they said. We remind everyone that these are allegations at this point, and that they are presumed innocent until proven guilty. Peters' legal defense fund, which she had said was also raising money for Nisley, did not return a request for comment Wednesday. In a statement from her campaign, Peters called the charges politically motivated accusations by Democrats. Using legal muscle to indict political opponents during an election isn't new strategy, but it's easier to execute when you have a district attorney who despises President Trump and any constitutional conservative like myself, who continues to demand all election evidence be made available to the public, she said. But a grand jury is one of the last cards the Democrats have to play here. They hope to influence voters enough with indictments and arrests and media drama during the primaries to elect a weaker general election opponent for Secretary of State Gina Griswold. The Colorado Republican Party, however, released a statement Wednesday afternoon urging Peters to drop out of the race until the legal process has concluded. It is our belief as leaders of the Colorado Republican Party that any Republican candidate who is indicted with felonies by a grand jury and who will be charged by a Republican district attorney should suspend their campaign while they undergo the legal challenges associated with those indictments, it stated. The Republican Party is the party of law and order, and we need every Republican voter focused on getting Republicans and constitutional conservatives elected across Colorado in 2022. Peters' campaign dismissed the request as a knee-jerk overreaction. Griswold said in a statement that every Coloradan, regardless of party, has the right to make their voice heard in accessible and secure elections. To do that, we need election administrators who are committed to following the law and election rules, Griswold said. Officials tasked with carrying out elections do so in public trust and must be held accountable when they abuse their power or position. Her office said Peters' actions were among the nation's first insider threats where an official elected to uphold free, fair, and secure elections risks the integrity of the election system in an effort to prove unfounded conspiracy theories. Colorado County Clerks Association Executive Director Matt Crane said it was clear from initial public reports that Peters violated her oath of office and likely broke the law, and that she admitted to those violations of her oath in court filings. As elected officials, we are devastated by this breach of trust, he said. County clerks are committed to our role as the guardians of our most sacred right as Americans, the right to vote in free, fair, and secure elections. In addition to Peters, Griswold launched investigations into the actions of county clerks in Elbert and Douglas counties this year over allegations of election security protocol breaches. Douglas County Clerk Merlin Klotz has been cleared, but the Secretary of State has sued Elbert County Clerk and Recorder Dallas Schroeder. Klotz and Schroeder are part of a lawsuit against Griswold's office calling for a third-party forensic audit into Colorado's election systems. Airstrike hits maternity hospital in Ukraine. 17 reported wounded. By Evgeny Meloletka, the Associated Press, byline Mariupol, Ukraine. A Russian airstrike devastated a maternity hospital Wednesday in the besieged port city of Mariupol amid growing warnings from the West that Moscow's invasion is about to take a more brutal and indiscriminate turn. Ukrainian officials said the attack wounded at least 17 people. The ground shook more than a mile away when the Mariupol complex was hit by a series of blasts that blew out windows and ripped away much of the front of one building. Police and soldiers rushed to the scene to evacuate victims, carrying out a heavily pregnant and bleeding woman on a stretcher as light snow drifted down on burning and mangled cars and trees shattered by the blast. Another woman wailed as she clutched her child. In a courtyard, a blast crater extended at least two stories deep. "Today, Russia committed a huge crime," said Volodymyr Nikulin, a top regional police officer, standing in the ruins. "It is a war crime without any justification." In Zhytomyr, a city of 260,000 to the west of Kyiv, bombs fell on two hospitals, one of them a children's hospital. Mayor Serhiy Sukhomlin said. He said the number of casualties was being determined. President Volodymyr Zelensky said the Mariupol strike trapped children and others under the rubble. A children's hospital, a maternity hospital. How do they threaten the Russian Federation? Zelensky asked in his nightly video address, switching to Russian to express his horror at the airstrike. What kind of country is this? The Russian Federation, which is afraid of hospitals, afraid of maternity hospitals, and destroys them. He urged the West to impose even tougher sanctions so Russia no longer has any possibility to continue this genocide. Video shared by Zelensky showed cheerfully painted hallways strewn with twisted metal. "There are few things more depraved than targeting the vulnerable and defenseless," British Prime Minister Boris Johnson tweeted, adding that Russian President Vladimir Putin will be held to account for his terrible crimes. The World Health Organization said it has confirmed 18 attacks on health facilities and ambulances since the fighting began, killing 10 people. It was not clear if that number included the assault on the maternity hospital. U.S. Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken condemned Russia's unconscionable attacks in a call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Dmytro Kuleba, the State Department said. 2 weeks into Russia's assault on Ukraine, its military is struggling more than expected, but Putin's invading force of more than 150,000 troops retains possibly insurmountable advantages in firepower as it bears down on key cities. Despite often heavy shelling in populated areas, American military officials reported little change on the ground over the past 24 hours. Other than Russian progress on the cities of Kharkiv and Mykolaiv. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity to assess the larger military situation. Authorities announced new ceasefires Wednesday to allow thousands of civilians to escape bombarded towns around Kyiv, as well as the cities of Mariupol, Inner Hodar, and Volnovakha in the south, Izum in the east, and Sumy in the northeast. People streamed out of Kyiv's suburbs, many headed for the city center, as explosions were heard in the capital and air raid sirens sounded repeatedly. From there, the evacuees planned to board trains bound for western Ukrainian regions not under attack. Civilians leaving the Kyiv suburb of Irpin were forced to make their way across the slippery wooden planks of a makeshift bridge because the Ukrainians blew up the concrete span leading to Kyiv days ago to slow the Russian advance. With sporadic gunfire echoing behind them, firefighters dragged an elderly man to safety in a wheelbarrow. A child gripped the hand of a helping soldier, and a woman inched her way along, cradling a fluffy cat inside her winter coat. They trudged past a crashed van with the words, "Our Ukraine," written in the dust coating its windows. We have a short window of time at the moment, said Yevhen Nishak, a member of Ukraine's Territorial Defense Forces. Even if there is a ceasefire right now, there is a high risk of shells falling at any moment. Previous attempts to establish safe evacuation corridors over the past few days largely failed because of what the Ukrainians said were Russian attacks. But Putin, in a telephone call with Germany's chancellor, accused militant Ukrainian nationalists of hampering the evacuations. In Mariupol, the strategic city of 430,000 people on the Sea of Azov, local authorities hurried to bury the dead from the past 2 weeks of fighting in a mass grave. City workers dug a trench some 25 yards long at one of the city's old cemeteries and made the sign of the cross as they pushed bodies wrapped in carpets or bags over the edge. About 1,200 people have died in the 9-day siege of the city, Zelensky's office said. Nationwide, thousands are thought to have been killed, both civilians and soldiers, since Putin's forces invaded. The UN estimates more than 2 million people have fled the country, the biggest exodus of refugees in Europe since the end of World War II. The crisis is likely to get worse as Moscow's forces step up their bombardment of cities in response to what appear to be stronger Ukrainian resistance and heavier Russian losses than anticipated. Echoing remarks from the director of the CIA a day earlier, British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said Russia's assault will get more brutal and more indiscriminate as Putin tries to regain momentum. The Biden administration warned that Russia might seek to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine, rejecting Russian claims of illegal chemical weapons development in the country it has invaded. This week, Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova, without evidence, accused Ukraine of running chemical and biological weapons labs with U.S. support. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki called the claim preposterous and said it could be part of an attempt by Russia to lay the groundwork for its own use of such weapons against Ukraine. House okays $13.6 billion for Ukraine in huge spending bill by Alan Fram, the Associated Press, byline Washington. The House approved a massive spending bill Wednesday night that would rush $13.6 billion in U.S. aid to battered Ukraine and its European allies after top Democrats were forced abruptly to drop their plan to include fresh funds to battle COVID-19. Passage of the Ukraine aid and the $1.5 trillion government-wide legislation that carried it let both parties lay claim to election year victories for their priorities. Democrats won treasured domestic initiatives. Republicans achieved defense boosts, and both got their imprint on funds to counter Russia's brutal invasion of its western neighbor. Senate approval was assured by week's end or perhaps slightly longer. Hours earlier, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, had to abandon the bill's $15.6 billion for combating the pandemic, a decision she called heartbreaking and that spelled defeat for a top priority of President Joe Biden and party leaders. The money was mostly to bolster U.S. supplies of vaccines, treatments, and tests and battle the disease around the world. But a Democratic revolt over Republican-demanded state aid cuts to cover the new initiative costs forced her to scrap that spending. We've got a war going on in Ukraine, Pelosi told reporters, explaining the urgency Democrats felt in making concessions in bargaining with Republicans. We have important work that we're doing here, she said, with her party in the 50-50 Senate needing at least 10 GOP votes to pass legislation. Democrats are going to have to know there has to be compromise. The House approved the overall bill in two votes. The measure's security programs were approved overwhelmingly by 361 to 69, the rest by 260 to 171, with most Republicans opposed. The Ukraine aid included $6.5 billion for the U.S. costs of sending troops and weapons to Eastern Europe and equipping allied forces there in response to Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion and repeated bellicose threats. There was an additional $6.8 billion to care for refugees and provide economic aid to allies, and more to help federal agencies enforce economic sanctions against Russia and protect against cyber threats at home. Biden had requested $10 billion for the package. Pelosi said she talked to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for 45 minutes Wednesday. She said they discussed the weapons and other assistance his country needs and the crimes against humanity that Putin is committing, including a Russian airstrike that destroyed a maternity hospital. "This is the beast that Putin is," Pelosi said. While enmity toward Putin and a desire to send assistance to the region is virtually universal in Congress, lawmakers have had a hard time finding unity on other steps. In one area of agreement, the House also planned to vote on a bill banning Russian oil imports. Biden imposed such a ban this week and levying other sanctions, underscoring lawmakers' eagerness to demonstrate they're taking action. Representative Tom Cole, Republican of Oklahoma, called the $1.5 trillion measure a reasonable compromise and said its extra defense spending was clearly necessary in the wake of Vladimir Putin's unprovoked aggression against Ukraine. In a remarkable and widespread rank-and-file rebellion, Democratic lawmakers froze the House into inactivity for most of Wednesday. Their demand, a refusal to accept Republicans' insistence that the new COVID-19 spending be paid for with cuts in previously enacted pandemic aid to 30 states. Pelosi eventually relented and decided to remove all pandemic spending from the government-wide $1.5 trillion package. That underscored the pressure Congress feels to help Ukraine resist the Russian invasion before it's too late, and to help nearby nations bolster their militaries and absorb more than 2 million refugees fleeing the fighting. The House planned to vote next week on a separate measure providing the full $15.6 billion for pandemic programs without cutting state aid. It was expected to pass, but face an uphill fight in the Senate, where strong GOP opposition seems fatal. The $1.5 trillion measure and its 2,741 pages would keep agencies functioning through September 30th, the end of the fiscal year. Since it began October 1st, the government has functioned on short-term measures that prevented federal shutdowns but held programs to levels agreed to under President Donald Trump. Democrats won a 6.7% increase over last year in domestic programs to a total of $730 billion. Republicans were able to boost defense programs to $782 billion, a 5.6% increase. Last spring, Biden proposed increases of 16% for domestic and just 2% for defense programs for this year. Neither was realistic because of Democrats' tiny congressional majorities. Since then, Russia's pummeling of Ukraine made it impossible for Democrats to resist defense increases, and the relentless pandemic, families' growing costs from inflation, and collapse of Biden's huge social and environment bill made it harder to stop Democrats' domestic boosts. The bill would increase spending for child nutrition and child care, local law enforcement, improving broadband in rural areas, and education aid for disabled students and historically black colleges and universities. The IRS would get an infusion to whittle down a big backlog of tax returns. There would be boosts for veterans' medical care, biomedical research, and processing migrants entering the U.S. at the southwestern border. Obituary: Denver jazz icon Ron Miles dies at 58, by John Wenzel, The Denver Post. Ron Miles, the legendary Denver-based jazz musician, educator, and prolific recording and stage artist, has died at 58. His death was confirmed by his label, New York-based Blue Note Records. According to a publicist there, Miles' manager and producer, Hans Wendel, said Miles died shortly before midnight Tuesday at his home in Denver in the presence of family. The cause was complications from polycythemia vera, a rare blood disorder, Miles' manager said. Ron was such a gifted artist, wrote Blue Note president and musician Don Was, who has recorded and played with Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, and Ringo Starr, in an email to the Denver Post. He was a sweet, soulful man whose character was reflected in every exquisite note he played. We are heartbroken to lose him so soon, but he will live forever through the music he's left behind for us. Miles, a Grammy-nominated trumpeter and composer, recently canceled a public performance in Knoxville, Tennessee's Big Ears Festival, which he played regularly in the past. He also said he was having health problems in recent weeks, although he wasn't specific about them, said Brett Saunders, a friend, 97.3 KCBO DJ and Denver Post jazz columnist. He was a really warm, gentle, caring presence to be around, Saunders said Wednesday. And like all great artists, his persona was reflected through his music, which sounded like Colorado when you're outside, wide open, lonely, and vulnerable. Miles's expansive career and singular progressive voice extended to coordinating the jazz program at Metropolitan State University of Denver, along with office mate and jazz legend Fred Hess, a tenor saxophonist and frequent musical collaborator who died in 2018. Miles established himself as one of today's most prominent jazz musicians, all while teaching the next generation of musicians at the university for more than 34 years, Metropolitan State University officials wrote in a statement. His music and educational contributions are truly legendary, as he has left a lasting legacy. So much great art came out of that office over the years, Saunders said of Miles' Metro State home base, where Miles also was a musician in residence. It's unreal. Ryan Warner of Colorado Public Radio initially broke the news of Miles' death via a Twitter post on Wednesday. The news also brought an instant outpouring of social media love for the musician, whose influence and reach were arguably unparalleled in Denver's jazz scene. Students and faculty from Metro State, in particular, wrote on Twitter that they lost an incredible teacher, a brilliant friend and colleague, according to Charles C. Lee, principal cellist for the Boulder Philharmonic. He was a wonderful man, wrote Denver comic Jeff Albright, a former Twist and Shout record store employee. He was a regular at Twist and Shout, and I always look forward to him coming in. Miles was born in Indianapolis on May 9, 1963, eventually moving to Denver in 1974 at age 11, according to his Blue Note biography. He went to East High School before attending the University of Denver and the Manhattan School of Music in the 1980s, according to Denver Post articles. His 35-year recording career included music for the prolific Capri, Gramavision, and Sterling Circle labels, Blue Note said. And his brilliantly melodic cornet has graced the work of Bill Frisell, a jazz guitar legend who grew up in Denver, Joshua Redman, Mercer Ellington, Madeline Perot, Jason Moran, The Bad Plus, and psych rock jazz pioneer Ginger Baker. On October 9th, 2020, Miles debuted on the iconic Blue Note label with Rainbow Sign after a Grammy nomination for his album with Redman, 2018's Still Dreaming. In a feature interview for the Denver Post, Saunders described Rainbow Sign as a sprawling, magisterial 70 minutes of music that captures numerous complex moods, illuminated by Miles' lonesome, singular tone. Miles was joined on that album by a group that represents the finest in jazz, Saunders wrote, that included internationally known names such as guitarist and friend Frisell, pianist Jason Moran, bassist Thomas Morgan, and drummer Brian Blade. Despite so many releases and so much praise over the years, it was one of Miles' highest career points. It was pretty surprising, Miles told Sanders about the Blue Note signing. We just made the album without a label in mind, and Bill Frisell asked me if he could play it for Don Was. A couple of days later, Don asked Bill for my number. It's not like they were looking to sign some old guy from the middle of the country. Don is a fan of music. The Blue Note album was motivated by the 2018 death of Miles' father, Faye Dooney, Miles said at the time. I was looking back on the journey of dealing with his journey, letting him know how much he was loved by us, and to take care of him in a respectful, loving way. Even when he passed, I was happy to get there on time. The record reached number 8 on NPR's National Jazz Critics poll, but Miles could have had a bigger career if he hadn't chosen to stay in Denver, Saunders said. Miles is survived by his wife, Carrie, daughter, Justice, son, Honor, mother, Jane, brother, Jonathan, sisters, Sherry Miles Cohen and Kelly West, and half-sister, Vicki M. Brown. Judge scolds majority. Four members of Douglas County School Board told to follow meetings law, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. A judge on Wednesday ordered the four majority members of Douglas County School District's Board of Education to follow Colorado's open meeting laws, including prohibiting them from having one-on-one meetings to discuss district business privately. The preliminary injunction issued by Douglas County District Judge Jeffrey Holmes comes after a Highlands Ranch resident filed a lawsuit against the school board members, alleging they violated state statute by holding a series of one-on-one meetings in late January to discuss replacing former Superintendent Corey Wise. Circumventing the statute by a series of private one-on-one meetings at which public business is discussed and/or decisions reached is a violation of the purpose of the statute, not just its spirit, Holmes wrote in his order. Robert Marshall filed the lawsuit against the directors Mike Peterson, Christy Williams, Becky Myers, and Kaylee Winiger after the board's three minority directors claimed their colleagues violated the state's open meeting law in their efforts to fire Wise. Wise was told that if he did not resign, four members of the board had already collectively decided to terminate his contract, according to the motion for a preliminary injunction. Wise was terminated without cause in a public meeting February 4th, a decision that drew protests by hundreds of the district's 63,000 students. The board was divided in the decision, voting 4-3 to fire Wise 2 years before his contract expired. The evidence indicates that four members of the board collectively committed, outside of public meetings, to the termination of Wise's employment, Holmes wrote in the injunction. The fact that no public comment was permitted at the February 4th meeting is additional evidence of the four board members' commitment to their course of action. The injunction does not nullify the board members' decision to terminate Wise. That decision has not been decided by the court. Paula Hans, a spokeswoman for the school district, declined to comment. An attorney for the four board members targeted in the lawsuit did not immediately respond to messages seeking comment. I hope it will send a message that you have to follow the law, basically, and not try to circumvent it, Marshall said. Under the state's open meeting law, if at least three school board members meet to discuss public business, then the public and other board members must be notified and the meeting made public. This includes if it is a meeting in person, by mail, email, or text. During a hearing last month, attorney Steve Zansberg argued that the four directors held a series of one-on-one phone calls to purposely not trigger the open meeting law when deciding Wise's future. It's gratifying that the judge understood that these types of efforts to evade the open records law cannot be condoned, Zansberg said Wednesday. Jeff Roberts, executive director of the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition, said Holmes's decision was potentially pretty important for the strength of Colorado's open meetings law. We haven't had any rulings like this in Colorado before, he said. Adams County, Treasurer Culpepper fires back, by John Aguilar, the Denver Post. Adams County Treasurer Lisa Culpepper turned up the heat Wednesday in a bitter internecine battle with fellow county officials, filing notice that she intends to sue Adams County for engaging in a criminal enterprise with the aim to damage her reputation and cause her reelection bid to fail. The notice, submitted by the Godfrey Johnson Law Firm, claims Adams County has caused Culpepper reputational damage, emotional distress, and extra work defending against false claims that she was derelict in her duties, damages she values at more than $1 million. Culpepper is running as a Democrat in November to retain her treasurer's seat, which she has held since 2019. These charges are without legal merit, and the relief requested is unconstitutional and represents an abuse of process, an attempt to subvert the constitutional separation of powers between the Board of Commissioners and the Treasurer's Office, she said in her notice. The notice to sue comes 4.5 months after Adams County's commissioners filed their own lawsuit against Culpepper, accusing her office of shoddy bookkeeping and failing to account for more than $200 million in taxpayer funds. That includes a more than six-month late accounting of $90 million in federal COVID-19 relief money and more than $500,000 sent by her office to taxing jurisdictions that weren't owed the money, the county claims. The county also claims the treasurer's office has done a poor job of replying to inquiries made by thousands of taxpayers about the status of their tax bills and remittances to the office. In January, Adams County's finance director warned the commissioners that a communication breakdown with Culpepper's department was jeopardizing her ability to complete a required annual audit, without which state officials could withhold millions of dollars in property tax proceeds and possibly bring county operations to a halt. The county alleges Culpepper failed to carry out her statutory duties and has asked a judge to appoint a receiver to manage Adams County's finances. Lynn Baca, chief of the Board of Commissioners, said the county is aware of the filing. At this time, no claims have been filed, she said in an emailed statement. We do not want to comment on a claim that has not yet come to fruition. Eva Henry, an Adams County commissioner, said Culpepper chose the audit company and had an attorney present during the audit. If she felt that there was a problem with the audit, she should have brought it up during the audit, she said. Culpepper, in her notice to the county, called consultancy Ide Bailey LLP, which audited her office last year, a partisan litigation consultant working on behalf of the county to support partisan political attacks on the treasurer. The firm, she said, did not perform an independent statutory audit of her department as required by law. Her notice to sue also claims the county attorney's office egregiously violated its professional obligations and duty of loyalty by manipulating its role as legal counsel to the treasurer's office to covertly gather information about the office to prepare the lawsuit it filed on behalf of a different client, the Board of Commissioners. The county's actions against her, she said in her notice, has caused and continues to cause critical damage to Ms. Culpepper's reputation while she is actively running for re-election and in the midst of campaigning for the primaries. Colorado's primary election is June 28th. Culpepper, an attorney who once worked on tax auditing and compliance in criminal investigations for the State Department of Revenue, cannot be removed from her position by the county commissioners, according to state statute. Bill that would give $500 to rent a spare room dies, by Alex Burness, the Denver Post. Older than 55? Got an extra room in your house? State Senator Paul Lundeen wants the government to pay you $500 to rent it out. But his idea is dead, for now, as a state Senate committee voted it down 3-2 on Wednesday afternoon. All three no votes came from Democrats, and both yes votes, including Lundeen's, came from Republicans. It's not that he isn't onto something, the Democrats said. Colorado is increasingly unaffordable to many, and housing shortages of hundreds of thousands of units squeeze people at low and medium income levels, in rural and urban communities alike. I get it. I get what you're trying to do, State Senator Joanne Ginnell of Fort Collins, leader of the local government committee, told Lundeen before the vote. I see this bill as something that right now, in its present state, is not ready for prime time. Lundeen's bill would have set up a three-year pilot program to provide one-time $500 incentive payments to homeowners at least 55 years old who rent space in their homes to tenants staying for at least 6 months. The bill would have cost up to $2 million, about a fifth of which would have gone to state administration of the program. We have an affordability of life crisis in Colorado, Lundeen, a Monument, told the Denver Post before the committee hearing. Housing is one of the most painful pressure points in that crisis. We drafted the bill as a light-touch effort to catalyze a market of pre-existing housing stock and people who need a roof over their head. Like any marketplace, it must work for both the provider and the customer. That invisible hand, instead of onerous government regulation, is a way to dramatically and quickly get more people into affordable housing. As a member of the minority party at the Capitol, Lundeen faced an uphill climb all along, and his is far from the first GOP bill to intrigue Democrats before dying. One common cause of such deaths, to hear Democrats tell it, is that Republicans, aware they don't have the numbers to pass their own bills, may sometimes be more interested in generating conversation and headlines than in passing well-vetted, impactful legislation. There's a difference between bills that are stakeholded and done through a long process and have an identified funding source, and bills that kind of drop out of nowhere that are part of a press conference and don't have dedicated funding, said the Senate President, Boulder Democrat Steve Fenberg, before Wednesday's hearing. The Democrats on the committee agreed with Ginnell and Fenberg that this one needs more work. Conifer's Tammy Story said the bill encouraged informal arrangements between homeowners and tenants, and said she found the prospect of such arrangements a little frightening. She also said that if the bill really had merit, it would have been thought of already by the Legislative Task Force on Affordable Housing, which this week debuted several bills that will make use of an historic influx of federal stimulus money from the American Rescue Plan Act. Chris Kulker of Centennial said he's worried about the potential for self-dealing among family members under Lundeen's plan. He conceded that this probably could be resolved through amendments and further discussion, and said his greater concern is the cost of the program. Ginnell herself, over 55 and a landlord, said the bill lacked adequate protections for those who would be involved in the rental arrangements Lundeen proposed. I don't want anyone to be abused, to be taken advantage of, she said. Lundeen repeatedly asked his colleagues to work with him to fix the problems they perceived. He also told the Post that he had at least one Democrat, Governor Jared Polis, who liked his plan and was ready to work on it. The governor's staff did not respond to a request for comment on the bill. The second Republican on the committee, Larry Liston of Colorado Springs, said it's not fair to cry foul on the bill's price tag, since that money could help create a few thousand new housing options for a state that badly needs them. I think this is a good, fair, honest attempt, he said. This isn't even a rounding error in the budget here in Colorado. Lawsuit seeks to stop group's door-to-door voter fraud hunt by Nicholas Riccardi, the Denver Post. A coalition of civil and voting rights organizations invoked the 19th century Ku Klux Klan Act in a lawsuit filed Wednesday, seeking to stop a group of Donald Trump supporters from going door to door in Colorado in a search for already debunked voter fraud. The lawsuit against the U.S. Election Integrity Plan alleges that the group's activities include photographing voters' homes and door to door voter intimidation in areas where a high number of minorities live. The group was founded after Trump lost the 2020 election to Democrat Joe Biden and made false claims of mass voter fraud. Sean Smith, a retired Air Force colonel who runs the group, did not immediately respond to a request for comments sent to Cause for America, a separate election integrity group he runs. USEIP has no listed phone number or email. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court for the District of Colorado on behalf of the state chapter of the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, and Mi Familia Vota. The move represents a high-profile push against a new method that election deniers have used to try to advance claims of voter fraud that have been dismissed roundly. Repeated audits and investigations, including by Trump's own Department of Justice, found no significant fraud in the 2020 election, and Trump backers lost more than 50 lawsuits trying to overturn the vote. The lawsuit relies in part on the KKK Act, which was passed after the Civil War to prevent white vigilantes from using violence and terror to stop black people from voting. The law recently has been cited in a lawsuit over the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Representative Benny Thompson, a Mississippi Democrat, accused Trump of conspiring with far-right extremist groups that were involved in storming the U.S. Capitol. The civil and voting rights groups allege that USEIP members sometimes carry firearms and badges during visits to voters' homes, even though they do not work for the government. It cites no specific examples. They're sending a very clear message that if you vote in the future of Colorado, you can expect an armed agent showing up at your door, said Courtney Hostetler, an attorney at the legal nonprofit Free Speech for People, which filed the case. USEIP thanks Mike Lindell, the chief executive of MyPillow and a major supporter of election deniers, in its organizing manual. Smith attended a meeting that Lindell organized on election conspiracy theories in August, along with Tina Peters, a clerk in Colorado's Western Mesa County, who was indicted by a grand jury Wednesday for her role in copying confidential election data that appeared on conspiracy websites after the event. The Colorado Secretary of State's office says Smith was on the telephone with a clerk in a second county as he made copies of information from his own election system and gave it to two people not authorized to view it. Last month, at a gathering of election conspiracy theorists, during a discussion of Colorado's Democratic Secretary of State, Smith said, "If you're involved in election fraud, then you deserve to hang." In late November, Lindell hired Smith to run Cause of America. In an interview on former Trump advisor Steve Bannon's podcast, Smith said the new organization would help coordinate the election integrity efforts of citizens across the country. Lindell did not immediately respond to a request for comment Wednesday. The lawsuit alleges that the U.S. Election Integrity Plan targets high-density housing that often is full of minority voters who are more likely to vote Democratic. Sometimes armed and donning badges to present an appearance of government officiality, USEIP agents interrogate voters about their addresses, whether they participated in the 2020 election, and, if so, how they cast their vote, the lawsuit said. It is reported that multiple agents have claimed to be from the county and have, without any evidence, falsely accused the residents of casting fraudulent ballots. The group says on its website it plans to expand to other states such as Arizona, Georgia, and New Hampshire. Its materials have been used by conspiracy theorists going door-to-door in Utah, according to the Salt Lake Tribune. "It's extremely scary," said Portia Prescott, president of the NAACP of Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana. "If the group knocks on someone's door," she said, "you feel like a target. They know how you vote. Will you vote the next time? Probably not." Longmont, among best places to work from home, by Kelsey Hammond, The Times Call. An American computer magazine ranked Longmont as one of the 20 best cities in the nation for working from home. According to a city news release, Longmont's NextLight municipal broadband service helped it achieve the recognition. Longmont landed at number 17 on PC Magazine's list for the best work-from-home cities for 2022. Valerie Dodd, NextLight's executive director, said in the release that reliable and affordable high-speed internet is crucial to daily life, especially with more people working from home than ever before. The release said the magazine has ranked NextLight among the fastest internet providers in the nation since 2018, with last year's list placing NextLight at number 3 in the U.S. The 2022 speed rankings are expected to be published this summer, the release said. Longmont Mayor Joan Peck said she's extremely proud of the top 20 recognition. Even though the coronavirus shut down our everyday routines, City of Longmont staff rolled up their sleeves and transitioned many CivD services online to keep serving our community, Peck said in the release. From recreation fitness classes to permit applications and city council meetings, we use technology to bring the city and its essential services into the homes and businesses of our community. In news briefs, state prison inmate dies after assault. An inmate's death at the Colorado Territorial Correctional Facility in Canyon City is being investigated as a homicide. On Tuesday morning, staff members at the medium security prison found an inmate on the floor of his cell with injuries that indicate he was assaulted, according to the Department of Corrections. Emergency workers treated the man, and he was taken by ambulance to a hospital, where he was pronounced dead. The incident is a suspected homicide, the DOC said. State law enforcement agencies are urged to donate body armor, helmets, to Ukrainians. Efforts are underway in Colorado to donate surplus body armor and ballistic helmets to besieged Ukrainians. The Office of Governor Jared Polis, the Colorado Department of Public Safety, and the Colorado Department of Military and Veterans Affairs are asking state law enforcement agencies to donate excess protective equipment to Ukrainians. The state is working with partners to deliver the items to Ukraine, according to a news release. Donations are being accepted only from law enforcement agencies, not from the public, the release said. Man sentenced to life in prison for a 2019 shooting death outside an Aurora nightclub. A man was sentenced Wednesday to life in prison for a 2019 shooting death outside an Aurora nightclub. Alexander Abayero, 46, was convicted by an Adams County jury on Friday of first-degree murder for the death of Juan Manuel Galindo Argumedo, according to a district attorney's news release. Early December 15, 2019, Abayero shot Galindo Argumedo outside a nightclub on East Colfax Avenue after the victim had asked Abayero's wife for a dance, according to a release. An enraged Abayero followed Galindo Argumedo outside the club and shot him in the torso with a handgun. The victim collapsed and died at a hospital. Abayero was sentenced Wednesday to life in prison without the possibility of parole. These were from Denver Post staff reports. In further news briefs, Netanyahu tests positive for coronavirus, Byline Jerusalem. Benjamin Netanyahu, the former prime minister of Israel, tested positive for the coronavirus Wednesday, according to his conservative Likud party. Spokesperson Yonatan Ulrich said Netanyahu, 72, feels well and that he was acting according to the country's coronavirus guidelines. The former prime minister was in parliament on Wednesday morning before being informed that he had tested positive. Netanyahu has received 4 vaccination shots, according to Ulrich. In January, Israel began offering a 4th shot to people age 60 and older. Australia declares national emergency after flooding. Byline, Melbourne, Australia. Prime Minister Scott Morrison declared a national emergency Wednesday as more than a week of severe rain along the country's eastern coast has caused some of the worst flooding in the nation's history and inundated swaths of 2 of its largest cities. Morrison said the declaration would fast-track aid and supplies to the most devastated areas, where the bodies of missing people have been found submerged in floodwaters and dozens of evacuation orders have forced thousands from their homes. It was the first time that a national emergency, a legislative power created after the deadly wildfires in early 2020, had been declared. U.S. man who got first pig heart transplant dies after 2 months. The first person to receive a heart transplant from a pig has died 2 months after the groundbreaking experiment, the Maryland hospital that performed the surgery announced Wednesday. David Bennett, 57, died Tuesday at the University of Maryland Medical Center. Doctors didn't give an exact cause of death, saying only that his condition had begun deteriorating several days earlier. Bennett's son praised the hospital for offering the last-ditch experiment, saying the family hoped it would help further efforts to end the organ shortage. Foreign policy newcomer wins South Korean election, Byline Seoul, South Korea. Unsuk Yeol, a conservative former top prosecutor and foreign policy neophyte, was elected South Korea's new president on Thursday, a victory expected to herald Seoul's drive to seek a stronger alliance with the United States and take a tougher line on North Korea. With about 99% of the votes counted early Thursday, Yoon, from the main opposition People Power Party, had 48.6% against ruling Liberal Democratic Party candidate Lee Jae-myung's 47.8%. It was South Korea's most closely fought presidential election. Conrad Janis, father on Mork and Mindy and much more, dies at 94. Conrad Janis, an actor familiar to television viewers as Mindy's father on the hit sitcom Mork and Mindy, who was also a skilled jazz musician and gallerist well known in the New York art world, died March 1st in Los Angeles. He was 94. Janis was on television from the medium's earliest days, playing numerous roles in the late 1940s and 50s, many of them on shows like Suspense, Actors Studio, and the Philco Television Playhouse that were broadcast live. He continued to play small parts on TV in the 1960s and 70s before landing his best-known role, Mindy's father. He continued to work in television after Mork, with appearances on St. Elsewhere, Murder, She Wrote, Frasier, and other shows. These briefs were from Denver Post Wire Services. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.